How many of us, when I say the phrase tough love, come up with something in your head? You automatically think of something. Tough love. All right, get a hand back there. Everybody else is kind of asleep, I guess. Tough love. And that's something that we all have heard, that phrase, right? Well, growing up in my household, I've told you about the tough love that I frequently received on the backside, so much so that I actually developed a callus. That's a joke. A lot of tough loving in my household. A lot of times there were spankings involved. And, you know, my dad, you know, he'd lay down across the bed and he'd take a belt and he'd tan your backside. And, in fact, it was just last August when he was spanking me that I said, "You must love me a lot, Dad," with tears in my eyes. No, I haven't got spanked in a couple of months at least. Tough love. Sometimes we think that we know what it's supposed to feel like when somebody cares for us. We think we know what it's supposed to feel like when somebody tells us they love us. But John Cougar Mellencamp in the 1980s wrote a song, and in that song he said something, he wrote something like this: "Sometimes love don't feel like it should. And sometimes, let me tell you, love don't feel like it should." The story we're going to look at today actually, I think, is a great example of that. We're going to turn to the book of John chapter 11, if you're not already there. We're going to look at a story that you guys are all very familiar with, I'm sure. We're going to point out a couple of things that hopefully you haven't thought of about, but hopefully, to me, the big picture is that sometimes love does not feel like it should. And we're going to hopefully keep that in our minds as we read this story. John chapter 11, beginning in verse 1. "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary, and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill." These two verses just set the chapter for the preceding, set the table for the preceding verses. They're just saying that Lazarus and Mary and Martha were friends of Jesus, and Lazarus was ill. We're also told here that Mary was going to anoint the feet of Jesus. She has not done this yet. That's not until the next chapter. But John's reminding the readers of who she is. Look at verse 3. "So the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, he whom you love is ill.'" Notice this thing. Notice this about this verse. It says, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." Jesus had a very special relationship with this family. Isn't it amazing to stop and think about how many people did Jesus Christ impact that we don't even know about? We don't know a lot about Lazarus, Mary, or Martha. But we know he had a special relationship with them. How many other countless people did he have an impact on? But she says this, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." And the word that they use there for love is the Greek word phileo. And that was a love of emotion. So they're reminding Jesus, "Lord, remember how you feel about Lazarus. Remember the emotional attachment that you have with him. Don't forget about him." Next verse, verse 4. "But when Jesus heard this, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" I'm going to read it one more time. "When Jesus heard it..." Am I getting ringing here? Is it just me? Okay. "When Jesus heard it, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" The word illness and the word it there, the very last word, are important because they're tied together. He says that God is going to be glorified through it. The it refers to the illness. God, isn't it amazing what God can glorify himself through? He's going to use an illness to his glory. Jesus states the purpose of this illness was just for that reason, to glorify God. And again, notice in this verse that Jesus says, "so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Notice that that's a close relationship. Jesus is saying that I have a close relationship with the Father. Jesus Christ usually refers to himself as the Son of Man, but in this case he says the Son of God. And he's demonstrating again his relationship with the Father. Verse 5. "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed two more days in the place where he was." Now John here uses another word for love to describe Jesus' relationship. John uses the Greek word agape. Now the sisters use the Greek word phileo, saying, "You have an emotional attachment to Lazarus. Don't forget about him, Jesus. Remember how you feel about him." But then John comes on the table. John comes and he writes this and he says, "Remember that Jesus had an agape love for Lazarus." It's much more significant than phileo. It means he had a commitment to Lazarus. He had a conviction to Lazarus. He wanted what was best for Lazarus. And sometimes we think we know what's best. We think that I know what's best for my life. And Mary and Martha, they thought what was best at the time was for Jesus to come and heal Lazarus. But it says here that Jesus delayed 2 days because he loved Lazarus. Hey, there's a sick brother in the hospital, Don Rule. Let's delay a couple days because I love him so much. That's what he's saying. I love this guy so much, I'm going to wait 2 days before I go see him. Why is he doing that? Because this illness is going to be for the glory of God. He loves him so much that he lets him sit there in his illness. And as we all know, well, let's just keep reading. Verse 7. Then after this, he said to the disciples, Lord, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. Jesus is reminded by his disciples that his life is in jeopardy. He says, Don't go back to that place, Jesus. I mean, they were there, they were trying to kill us. And Jesus, he's not concerned about his own life. And in fact, he tells a little, uses a figure of speech to try to encourage his disciples to not be afraid. I've told you guys on countless occasions how big a coward I am. I mean, I don't think we need to rehash that. But every time, let me tell you, no matter how afraid I am in the middle of the night, when the light comes up, I feel better. I mean, that closet, all of a sudden, I walk in that closet and I'm not afraid of anything in there anymore. But during the night, when that closet is spooky, I hang out on the outside. If I need something, I need my shirt. Send her in that spooky closet. But here Jesus is saying, look at this again, verse 9, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. Earlier in three chapters earlier, in John chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus said, Again Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus reminds them of what he had just earlier said. If you're with me, you're with the light. There's no reason to be afraid when it's lit up. You're not going to fall in the dark. We may go to that area. They may be wanting to kill us, but if you're with me, there's no reason to fear. We sang the song this morning on the overhead, and I told you it was a new song, but the reason I wanted to sing that is because it's a quote from Psalm 27:1. And that quote is, The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? I'm going to read that one more time. The Lord is the light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? And Jesus reminds his disciples, there's no reason to be afraid. There's no reason that we shouldn't go forward, because you're with me, and I'm the light of the world. Verse 11. After saying these things, he said to them, Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. My wife will often tell you that I'm clueless about many things, and especially financial. I mean, I don't have any idea what's going on in finances in the world. The disciples are almost clueless in this case. He says, Lazarus is asleep. The disciples don't understand what this means. Well, if he's sleeping, that's great. He's going to recover. So then Jesus has to tell them plainly, he's dead. Lazarus is no longer with us. He's passed away. I think it's also, at this point, important to remember that even those who are close to God go through hardships. Even those close to God go through struggles. Jesus Christ's father likely passed away when he was a young boy. I mean, somewhere between his 12th birthday and his 30th birthday, it is likely that he passed away. Jesus could have saved him, couldn't he? What about how many other people could Jesus have saved that he cared about, loved? But Jesus understood that death is a part of this world. And even those who he is close to still have to suffer. You may be going through hardships, you may be going through struggles, but that's no different than those who were the friends and family of Jesus Christ in the first century. So Lazarus here, he's dead. His family is grieving. Notice verse 15 one more time. Lazarus has died, verse 14, and for your sake I am glad I was not there. That almost seems brutal, doesn't it? It almost seems calloused and cold. I'm glad I wasn't there. But he's not just being calloused and cold. He has the big picture in mind. He said, I'm glad I wasn't there. And look at the rest of the verse. So that you may believe. He knew that in going there, the illness would be resulting in death eventually. He knew that through this death of Lazarus, that he could make their faith grow in ways they never thought their faith could go. Faith, and I'm going to say this term a lot this morning, faith is a progressive thing, and theirs needed to keep on growing. Let's pick up in verse 16. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Lord, let us also go, that we may die with him." We always call Thomas Doubting Thomas, and he kind of has a bad rap for what happened after Christ's death. Unless I see the holes in his hands and his feet and put my hand in his side, I'm not going to believe in Jesus that he's resurrected. But here Thomas says, "Let us go, we may die with him." Thomas does not understand the plan of Jesus Christ, but he has faith in the man who's in control of that plan. So he says, "Let's go." He doesn't understand it, but what a great statement of faith. I may die, but I'm going anyways. Let's look at the next verse, verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been dead in the tomb for 4 days. Now 4 days is a very significant amount of time, especially to the Jews. I want to read you a quote from the IVP commentary. "For Jews, this probably signifies that Lazarus is clearly dead and beginning to decay. A later Jewish text that cites an authority from the early 3rd century AD says that mourners should continue to come to the tomb for 3 days because the dead person continues to be there. Mourning is at its height on the 3rd day, presumably because it is the last time the dead person will be present there. Bar Kappara taught, until 3 days after death, the soul keeps on returning to the grave, thinking that it will go back into the body. But when it sees the facial features have become disfigured, it departs and abandons it." So the 4th day was very significant. The Jews thought, there's no chance now. The spirit's already left. No one can resurrect a man on the 4th day. And in fact, we're going to even see a comment by Sister Martha later on that she too thought this was just, you know, out of the picture. Pick up in verse 18. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Now John makes a point to remind us that they are in the very vicinity of the place where those Jews who were at, they were trying to find Jesus to kill him. He says he went back into the lion's den for Lazarus is what he's doing here. And he also makes a point to tell us that there was a lot of Jews there. There are many Jews there. It's not just Lazarus' sisters, Martha and Mary, and the disciples. It says many Jews came from the city to console them. Verse 20. Remember the many Jews thing. It'll come back in a minute. Verse 20. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into this world." Martha demonstrates in that a great deal of faith, doesn't she? She says, "Lord, if you had been here, he would not have died. I know you could have healed him, Lord." She demonstrates a great amount of faith. She understands he has the power to heal illness. But still, her faith needed to make some progress. It was not where it needed to be. So Jesus then asks a question, doesn't he? He says, "Do you believe that he will resurrect?" She says, "Yes, Lord, I believe that." And look at how he responds. Verse 25. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life." Now, Jesus here uses that phrase that we hear so many times in the Old Testament. "I am." This was a very important phrase. Just like Jesus did earlier in John chapter 8, verse 58, where he told the Pharisees and the Sadducees, "Before Abraham was, I am." He was claiming to be God in that case, and he is here too. "I am" is a claim of deity. He said, "I am the resurrection and the life." And he would even expand on what that meant. Resurrection. He says, "Though he die, yet shall he live." That's resurrection. Though he is dead, yet shall he live. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Life. "Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." He says, "I am God. I am the God of resurrection. I'm the God of life. I'm not just the God of healing." He wants Martha to get this. He wants Martha to grasp this. Her faith is not where it needs to go. She makes a great statement, doesn't she? Look at verse 27. "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." She makes a great statement there. But she, as we're going to see later on in verse 39, she's not where she needs to be. Verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." She was just at the place she needed to be when going through a hard time. She was at the exact place she needed to be when going through hardships, the feet of Jesus Christ, worshiping him, asking him for comfort. That's where she needed to be. That's where we need to be when we're going through hard times. That's where we need to be when we think that things couldn't get any worse, at the feet of Christ. Let's look at the next verse, verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Notice in verse 33 that Jesus sees our pain, he sees our anguish. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who were with her also weeping, so Jesus sees it, but he just does not see the weeping. He does not just see the pain. That's a hard phrase for me to say. He goes much beyond that. He sees it, and it bothers him that we're in pain. It bothers him that we're in anguish. It bothers him that we're in sorrow. Look at what it says. Halfway through verse 33 says, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. I want to read to you another quote from the IVP commentary. The word for deeply moved can be used of snorting in animals, and in humans refers to anger. The second word, troubled, is literally, he troubled himself. So a better translation would be, he became angry in spirit and very agitated. Jesus sees the pain and the suffering these people are going through, and he's angry about it. Why would Jesus be angry? Who is he angry at? He's angry at the fact that Satan has came into the world and impacted it in such a negative way. He's angry at the fact that death has came in and gripped every single one of the people that's ever walked the face of this earth. He's angry at the evil and suffering that we have to endure. It's been said that in the book of John that life is the major theme, or at least one of the major themes, and if this is the case, he is facing one of his major enemies in this book. He's facing death. Let's pick up in verse 34. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. In verse 35, Jesus weeps. God the Creator sheds a tear on behalf of his creation. Do you think that God didn't know? Do you think that Jesus didn't know he was just going to go and resurrect him? Jesus knew he was going to do this. Yet he sheds a tear. I remember Bette Midler wrote a song also. I think it was in the 80s. Maybe it was the 90s. I don't remember. Bette Midler wrote a song called "From a Distance." She says in that song, in essence, that God watches over us from a distance. Let me tell you, he's not watching over us from a distance. He's right here, smack dab in the middle of us all. He sees our pain, he's angry over it, and he's saddened because of it. It says Jesus wept. To me, those are two of the most powerful words in the whole Bible. His compassion, his loving, his caring attitude, when he knew the whole time, all he had to do was speak the word and he could come out. He's not weeping on behalf of Lazarus. He's weeping on behalf of all the others. He's weeping on behalf of those who are sorrowful. He's weeping on behalf of those who are in pain. The Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 12, "Weep with those who weep." This is exactly what Jesus Christ is doing. He's torn up because of it, and he's shedding a tear. Verse 36. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind have also kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Verse 38 says, Jesus, deeply moved again. The New King James Version says, groaning in himself. He comes to the tomb. Now, it's been 4 days. There's a lot of Jews there. They're following the family. They're following Mary. They're following Martha, who are all following Jesus Christ. They go to the gravesite. Jesus says, Where have you buried him? They bring him to there. He sees the tomb, and it says he groans in himself. Calvin wrote concerning this verse, I want to read this. Christ does not come to the sepulcher as an idle spectator, but like a wrestler preparing for the contest. Therefore, it is no wonder that he groans again, for the violent tyranny of death which he had to overcome stands before his eyes. Again, if life is the major theme and death is the enemy, Jesus now is at the, he's in the ring. He's groaning. He's ready for battle. He groans within himself. He's deeply moved as he stands before the gravesite. Verse 39, Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Let's stop for a second. Again, remember the scene here. He's been dead 4 days. Nobody thinks he can resurrect him after 4 days. Jesus, why are you taking the stone away? It's not going to be pretty in there, Jesus. Think about this for a second, Lord. What are you going to do? Come on, he's rotting. And in fact, look at the rest of that verse. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days." He stinks, Jesus. He smells bad. What are you going to open that for? What are you going to go in there for? What do you want to see him for? Verse 40. Jesus said to her, "Did not I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" She said that great phrase earlier in verse 27. "You are the Christ, the Son of God." But here she says, "Don't open it, Jesus. You don't know what you're getting into. He stinks." She is not where she needs to be. Her faith needed to make some progress, and Jesus is trying to help it make that progress. This is the very reason. This death of Lazarus, the reason he's at the tomb now with the stone rolled away, is the very reason that he stayed 2 days there. It's the very reason that he tells his disciples, "I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you can see the glory of God." These things that he said earlier, the things that he did earlier, are all for the purpose that's about to be revealed. Let's pick up the next verse, verse 41. "So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me.'" Verses 41 and 42. Jesus here prays to the Father for the benefit of those that are there. He doesn't pray to the Father out loud for his benefit. He says, "I'm praying for the benefit of those that are here, that they may know that you have sent me." So he prayed for the benefit of those to demonstrate that he had a relationship with the Father. He says, "I want them to know that I am working on behalf of you, that you have sent me." Isn't it important to have somebody validate something? I mean, if I just said to you, "You know, I'm contemplating becoming a bodyguard," how many of you guys would think you're an idiot? Raise your hand. All right, okay. I would, because I'm a coward. It goes back to the whole coward thing, remember that? Okay, if I said, "I'm thinking about becoming a bodyguard," and you said, "Well, why would you become a bodyguard?" And I said, "Well, watch this." And I get down on the floor and I do one push-up. And I'm really straining and I have beads of sweat after that push-up. And I say, "Well, I do two jumping jacks," and I'm worn out and I sit down. So now you see why I'm becoming a bodyguard, because I'm in great shape. You'd be like, "Oh man, you're a dead man. The person you're going to be guarding, they're a dead man." But now if I hop down on the ground and I bumped out 200 push-ups and I ran a 4-minute mile and then I was, you know, doing some martial arts, you'd be, "Oh, that Nathan, I can see why he's a bad man. I can see why he's going to be a bodyguard." I validated what I was saying with my actions, right? I demonstrated that, hey, I am capable of being a bodyguard. I demonstrated it. I validated it. Jesus here is speaking the words. He's saying, "I'm going to be a bodyguard." He's saying, "Father, the Father sent me." Those that are around and hearing this, they're like, "Yeah, anybody can say that the Father has sent them. Anybody can make the claims you're making." But Jesus is going to do something that's going to validate it. He's going to do something that demonstrates, "I'm not just talking it, I'm walking it." You remember earlier in Luke chapter 5, there was a young man who was brought to Jesus Christ who was paralyzed. His friends bring him, and they said, they let him down to the roof, and he's there in front of all these people. And Jesus looks at this man on this mat, and he says to him, "Your sins are forgiven." Again, there's the statement, but what does it mean? Your sins are forgiven. That's a great statement, if I can say that I know for a fact that's true. So everybody is saying in their minds, how does this guy have the power or the authority to forgive sins? But then Jesus validates his claim to forgive sins by what he does next. When he says, "Take up your bed and walk." And a man who's been paralyzed from birth stands up and carries something out. The claim he was making was just now validated. And we're going to see this claim that he's making here in John 41 and 42 validated in just a second. Look at verse 41 one more time. It says, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me." Go back to the beginning of the verse. So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. Jesus looks up to heaven. He demonstrates that he's focusing on God the Father. And then he calls him Father. He doesn't call him Jehovah. He says Father, again demonstrating his relationship with him, saying, you are, this is a relationship of a family. This is a close relationship. So he's making some pretty tremendous claims here. And again, notice Jesus' confidence in verse 42. I knew that you always hear me. Look at those two phrases. I knew and always. He has complete confidence in his relationship with the Father. He says, I'm not doubting at all. I know that you always hear me. I'm not doubting. 100% confident. He is 100% confident in what he is asking God the Father. Not only that he hears it, but he's going to be granted it. Let's pick up in verse 43. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. He comes to the tomb, the site of the battle, and he doesn't make some incantations. He doesn't pull out some little, you know, herbs and sprinkle it around the place. He doesn't do a little dance. He gives a command to a dead man, and he walks out of the grave. He gives a command to a man who's been dead for 4 days. His body's rotting, and he comes out of the grave. That statement he made earlier about being having this relationship with God the Father, validated. I love going to movie theaters when they validate my parking pass. I don't have to pay. Validate. It's taken care of. It's true. The claims he made are now proven. That's what he's trying to say. I have been validated. I have been glorified. God the Father has been glorified. And in verse 44, this is like a cry of victory, isn't it? Unbind him and let him go. That's powerful. Look at the verses one more time. The man who had died, look at these next two words, came out. I have never seen a dead man walk. But the man who had died came out. He was still bound. His face was still wrapped. And Jesus says, unbind him and let him go. Those are amazing statements. He just defeated death on behalf of one man. But in this... Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Remember this. While this glorified God the Father and Jesus Christ, what glorified God the Father and Jesus Christ even more? Was it not the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus Christ himself? Well, Jesus Christ coming to this tomb and resurrecting Lazarus sets the table for his own death, as we're going to see in the next verses. So he really, through glorification he's receiving here, is setting the table for a much greater glorification that's going to come. Let's pick up in verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. Remember again, there are a lot of Jews there. And they have just seen Jesus Christ validate his claims. Verse 46. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. Isn't it amazing what a great miracle just occurred? And some are unhappy because of it. A great and beautiful and wonderful and magnificent. All the great words you can think of to describe this event still don't do it justice. And yet some look at this event and say, we need to shut this down. We need to stop this. Let's skip down to verse 53. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. John says, following the resurrection of Lazarus, the Jews really stepped up to the plate and said, let's kill him now. I want to read to you from Dodd. Jesus is now formally devoted to death by a vote of the competent authority. I want to read to you another quote on the phrase, they made plans. It was written by a man named Bamble. This is what it says. They made plans, or better, they resolved or determined or even passed a resolution to do these things. They said, you know what, we absolutely have to shut him down now. He's making too much of an impact. He's making too much of a splash in the world. We have to shut him down. Again, notice the irony. Lazarus' life is only saved because Jesus Christ is going to give his for him. Lazarus' physical body is only resurrected because Jesus Christ is going to give up his physical body. Now we're going to be raised spiritually because of the same thing. Because Jesus Christ gave his physical body, we're going to be raised spiritually. Jesus Christ did this. This is what he has done for us. It is because of Jesus' love that he allowed Lazarus to die. Sometimes love does not feel like it should. Mary and Martha did not understand how this could be love. How could it be love if you let my brother die? God has shown his love for us, promising to raise us from the grave as well. He made an agreement with us that he will not break. He has validated his claims. I want to read you one more verse from Isaiah 49, and then I will. The lesson will be yours. Isaiah 49, verse 15. Can a woman forget her nursing child that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Can a woman forget her nursing child? I mean, I'm telling you what, my wife has never once forgot about our nursing son. First of all, there's that emotional attachment. But beyond that, there's a physical attachment. She physically needs to feed my son. There's a physical need for a nursing mother to feed her child. And Isaiah says, can a woman forget her nursing child that she may have no compassion on the son of her womb? But then he goes on, even these may forget. Check out these next words. Yet I will not forget you. That's God the Father. He's told us he will not forget us. He will not leave us in the grave. Why did he do these things? Why did he do this? Because he loved us, because he's committed to us, and because he will never forget us. If there are any here tonight, this morning, who have any needs, we can be of assistance with any tip this morning that have not put the Lord on a baptism, unaware of the biblical teachings on baptism, would like to have a Bible study, anything at all that we can be of assistance with, please come as we sing the song that's been selected.